Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Joe Stork of Human Rights Watch, who assesses the conduct of Israeli troops in their assault on the Jenin refugee camp and Israel's delay in allowing a United Nations team access to investigate. Edgardo Lander, professor of sociology at the Central University of Venezuela, who reports on the Venezuelan media's coverage of the coup attempt which failed to bring down the government of President Hugo Chavez. And author and activist Jim Hightower, who talks about his traveling political carnival, the Rolling Thunder Down Home Democracy Tour. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
The Guardian newspaper reports that sectarian violence continues to explode in the state of Gujarat, India. In a melee in mid-April, 17 people were killed and over 100 injured in a new round of Hindu-Muslim clashes. Narendra Modi, Gujarat's chief minister and a member of the ruling Hindu nationalist Bharatiya Janata Party, blames the violence on malicious propaganda in the media, who are spreading what he says are untruths. However, a British commission blames Modi and the nationalist BJP for the rising death toll that since February 27th has claimed 2,000 mostly Muslim victims. The European Union recently insisted that the bloodshed in Gujarat was a kind of apartheid and had parallels to Nazi-era Germany. Meanwhile, the ruling BJP and other Hindu hardliners defend Modi and his administration. India's Prime Minister Vajpayee remains silent, and his ruling BJP party is losing international credibility. However, many political insiders believe the violence may keep nationalists in power by inflaming the passions of the majority Hindu. The next election is set for 2004. On April 11th, military leaders ousted Venezuelan President Hugo Chavez after a violent clash between National Guard troops, police, and Chavez supporters and opponents. The coup lasted just 48 hours, with Hugo Chavez being reinstated as president of the republic. Chavez was elected in 1998 after a landslide electoral victory. He claimed he would overhaul a corrupt judiciary, curb inflation, and increase social spending. Chavez has been critical of the U.S. war in Afghanistan and denied the U.S. access to Venezuelan airspace, thus restricting Washington's proxy war in Colombia. He has also become a close ally of Cuban President Fidel Castro, supplying the island nation with much-needed oil. The Bush administration has stated it is completely unacceptable for Venezuela to sell oil to Cuba. Venezuela is the third largest supplier of oil to the U.S. and boasts the largest petroleum reserves outside the Middle East. However, Ali Rodriguez, the newly appointed president of the state-owned oil company Petróleos de Venezuela, stated on Monday, April 29th, that Venezuela will continue to provide Cuba oil in accordance with a two-year-old bilateral contract that gives generous discount in financing terms. Opponents of Chavez charge that Venezuela can ill afford to offer discounted crude. Chavez has maintained a higher oil price to help fund social programs. The question remains, will the U.S. and its elite allies in Venezuela again attempt to oust Chavez and regain control of Venezuela's oil supply? Standing on the banks of the North Fork Elk River in Northern California, Christy Wrigley, who runs an apple orchard, assessed the damage done by the clear-cutting of redwood forests. The river has turned brown, making the water unsafe to drink or swim in. Downstream, Wrigley has seen her apple crop go bad. For the first time, her apple groves were flooded with sediment-laced river water. Now the apple harvest has fallen 50%, and some of the trees have yellow leaves and are dying. The pollution is the result of sediment coming from areas clear-cut by the Pacific Lumber Company, bought out in the mid-1980s by Texas financier Charles Hurwitz, with the help of junk bond trader Michael Milken. Hurwitz was the target of a campaign by environmentalists working to stop his company from cutting down redwoods in California's Headwaters Forest. The dispute over the status of the Headwater Grove was officially settled in 1999, when the federal government paid $480 million for the old-growth redwood forest and promised more public access to the ancient woods. According to Forest Magazine, questions are being raised about the amount of sediment still coming from Pacific Lumber's timber operations. Now, the company says there are few restrictions from the Headwaters Pact over how much timber it can cut, but a number of the company's timber sites are considered sediment-impaired zones under the Clean Water Act, and the U.S. Forest Service is thinking about placing new limits on Pacific Lumber. The company has refused an order by the California Resources Quality Board to monitor sediment levels and filed a lawsuit against the board claiming it overstepped its powers. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon and your reporter Denise Manzari.
Weeks after President Bush demanded that Israel withdraw its forces from West Bank cities, Prime Minister Ariel Sharon has launched several new attacks on Palestinian communities, including Hebron, inside the disputed territories. While negotiators made progress on ending the Israeli siege of Yasser Arafat's Ramallah headquarters, the standoff at Bethlehem's Church of the Nativity remained unresolved at production time, where more than 200 Palestinians were surrounded by Israeli troops and tanks. Israel claims that 25 of those inside Christianity's most holy site are wanted on terrorism charges. Another stalemate continued in the United Nations effort to investigate the conduct of Israeli troops during their 8-day attack on the Jenin refugee camp. Allegations by Palestinians that Israeli forces had committed a massacre there are still unsubstantiated. But Prime Minister Sharon has delayed a UN team from entering the camp to begin its Security Council-endorsed human rights investigation and has also barred access to UN High Commissioner Mary Robinson. Israel has complained about the composition and mission of the team. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with Joe Stork, Washington Director of Human Rights Watch Middle East and North Africa Division. He assesses the conduct of Israeli troops in their assault of the Jenin refugee camp and the precedents which could be set in this affair for future international human rights investigations.
Well, I think our concern in this latest assault is basically the same as it has been ever since the outbreak of clashes a year and a half ago, and that's namely that it's civilians on both sides who've been paying the highest price. In the case of the attacks of the last couple of weeks, I think Jenin is in a sense only the tip of the iceberg. I think we're talking about basically humanitarian catastrophe, destruction on a wide scale, a pattern of killings, of unlawful killings of unarmed civilians. We have a team that's been in Jenin for the last couple of weeks. We have not found evidence. We don't think there is evidence of any widespread killings numbering in the hundreds, as some allegations have had it. But nevertheless, we found a pattern of very, very serious violations of humanitarian law, in some cases requiring criminal investigation.
Could you go into a little detail about some of what your team has found in Jenin?
One thing we found is a very disturbing pattern of willful killings of civilians in circumstances where there doesn't appear to have been any military justification, in cases where there was not ongoing armed conflict. So that's one thing. Another thing that's incontrovertible is that the IDF, the Israel Defense Forces, basically prevented any humanitarian access and medical access for sick and wounded, not only during the period when the clashes were going on, but also for several days afterwards, badly aggravating an already terrible situation.
Have you been able to confirm some of the reports that we've seen in the press about houses bulldozed on civilians, killing or injuring them, and other reports where the Israeli forces were using civilians as human shields as they made their way around the conflict zone?
In brief, yes, we did find, first of all, that there was extensive destruction to civilian property, again, on a scale that appears to be unrelated to any consideration of military necessity. In fact, the most severe destruction using the armored bulldozers came at a point after the fighting had essentially died down, and this suggests that we're looking at a policy of that amounts to collective punishment rather than something designed to meet a military objective.
Can you comment for us on the difficulties the United Nations has had in getting their team of investigators into the Jenin refugee camp specifically to look into allegations of human rights abuses there?
My reading of what's going on is that, and for the Israeli government's about face on this after first agreeing to it, is that as it has become pretty clear that the sort of the term massacre, or massacre as used to apply to, say, hundreds of civilians in the fighting in Jenin, as it's become more and more clear that that is that those allegations are not substantiated, and that what we're looking at instead are certainly less numerous deaths of civilians, but still, as I said, in circumstances that warrant investigation, in some cases criminal investigation, that is at this point that the Israeli government has decided they don't want anybody poking around. And, you know, I'll let your listeners determine as to what, you know, if this amounts to a cover-up or not. But I think, you know, it's a very serious matter, and we certainly have urged the government of Israel to cooperate fully with the UN fact-finding team.
The government of Israel has objected to one or more members of the United Nations investigating team, and I wonder, in the minds of you over at Human Rights Watch, what are the precedents for this in the past, and what are some of the ramifications for future human rights delegations from the UN if countries that are being investigated can somehow screen or select their own investigators?
Israel is not the first country that, when it has come under this kind of international scrutiny, and where there has been some form of international investigation has been mandated through the UN, that the country involved has tried to, as you say, screen the determine who would actually come and carry out the investigation, and basically try and establish a veto over the persons delegated to that task. We had that situation a couple of years ago in the Congo, in the Democratic Republic of Congo, for instance. We had it in Burundi. I mean, you have it in Iraq with the efforts of the Iraqi government to determine who will conduct, you know, who's acceptable to them to conduct arms inspections. So, it's, as I say, it's a familiar pattern. In those cases, the UN has held firm. In fact, so far, the Secretary General has held firm in this case as well. You know, the need for this kind of accountability lies not only on the Israeli side, it also lies on the Palestinian side. I mean, some of these atrocities that have been carried out by the Palestinian militant groups like Hamas and Islamic Jihad and the Al-Aqsa Brigades, I mean, these involve targeting civilians, absolutely, crimes of war. So there's no question that the issue of accountability applies to the same degree to those kinds of crimes.
That was Joe Stork, Washington Director of Human Rights Watch Middle East and North Africa Division. Contact the group at area code 212-290-4700 or visit their website at www.hrw.org. A coalition of conservative Venezuelan businessmen and sectors of the armed forces failed in their April 11th attempt to overthrow the democratically elected government of President Hugo Chavez. The 48-hour coup was quickly reversed by both a popular uprising and a mutiny by members of the military still loyal to Chavez. But the Bush administration's initial friendly reaction to the coup has fueled speculation that Washington had a hand in planning the coup, owing to the CIA's well-documented history of undermining or overthrowing democracies in Latin America and around the world. Since Chavez was restored to power, the U.S. press has published several stories that detail the hundreds of thousands of dollars that were funneled to the coup plotters by the congressionally funded National Endowment for Democracy and the international arm of the AFL-CIO in the months before their grab for power. Other stories allege that the U.S. Navy may have provided signals intelligence to key members of the Venezuelan military involved in the overthrow attempt. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with Edgardo Lander, professor of sociology at the Central University of Venezuela, who reports on the Venezuelan media's coverage of the coup attempt and the speculation that the U.S. was complicit in the affair.
There's no country in the world that should be more concerned with U.S. participation in the coup than Venezuela. And this is hardly mentioned in the media in Venezuela. It's not mentioned at all on TV. I mean, it's simply not an issue on television. And it appears as rumors in some of the newspaper articles and some comments, but nothing to do with the way it's been discussed in the mainstream media in the States.
As you know, in the United States, there have been press reports indicating that the congressionally funded National Endowment for Democracy, both the Democratic and Republican parties that received that money, had funneled many hundreds of thousands of dollars to the opposition groups who later formed the nucleus of this coup attempt. There have also been published reports about U.S. military presence on the island where President Hugo Chavez was brought for a brief detention before the coup was reversed. What can you tell us about these reports and how this news has been greeted in Venezuela?
It's almost $1 million that have been sent to this organization. This is an enormous amount of money that has been spent in propaganda and mobilization. And I think this has had a significant influence on the way the opposition has handled the situation. This has hardly been published in the Venezuelan press. One of the most important things for a balance of the political situation and really for a balance of what democracy is about currently has to do with the role of the media. A democratic society requires the democratic media. I mean, one of the main human rights is the right to have information. And in Venezuela, that right is denied day after day. And it's not denied by government censorship or by any government policy restricting information. It's denied by the fact that media is absolutely monopolized by a few very powerful groups, and these people conduct the media as political resources in terms of their own agenda. And this is incredible. I mean, after the coup, we had 2 days in which we had mass mobilizations all over the place, people reacting to the coup, and the Venezuelan media decided unanimously to absolutely ignore this. And we had this information over CNN, over Radio Caracol from Colombia, on internet. We had telephone calls from people in Madrid telling us that something was happening in this part of the city. And the media had soap operas and animal programs and American series. I mean, it was just incredible. I mean, they just decided to ignore the situation because they decided that this reaction to the coup was against their interest. And so this isn't the media. I mean, these are instruments of political action, and that's what they are. Something has appeared in the Venezuelan press is the fact that all the main media owners, every single one of them, was meeting in Miraflores, which is the presidential palace, the day after the coup, and they stayed there for most of the day, and they were part of the coup. In terms of U.S. participation, I think that, as usually happens in these situations in Latin America, it's only after a few years when all these secret documents and communications are declassified that we'll get to really know what happened during the coup and to what degree the U.S. had a participation. I mean, in terms of the people who are in charge of U.S. Policy for Latin America and the State Department, the very Cold War people, very aggressively anti-communist. I mean, these are people of Reagan area who participated in the Iran-Contra and in counterinsurgency in Central America, etc. So it's to be expected that they'll carry out the same policies. But we won't know for a while.
Is President Chavez aggressively investigating this issue, either publicly or behind the scenes, to get some of this information?
The way the Venezuelan government is handling this is to try to downplay U.S. participation as much as possible to preserve its stability. I mean, it can't become aggressive in terms of denouncing or investigating U.S. participation because this would increase confrontation with the United States. And it's almost impossible to survive as a Latin American government if you have a very frontal opposition from the United States. So I think their policy has been and will probably continue to downplay U.S. intervention. So it's up to U.S. media and U.S. people in terms of the Freedom of Information Act, etc., to try to get the information out.
That was Edgardo Lander, professor of sociology at the Central University of Venezuela. Jim Hightower, a former Texas Agriculture Commissioner, author, and populist commentator, has for many years advocated that progressive groups come together in a grand coalition to provide the public with an attractive alternative to the stale ideas of the Democrats and Republicans, who have a virtual monopoly on U.S. politics. On a sunny March day in Austin, Texas, Hightower, with the backing of 40 national organizations, including the Communications Workers of America and the Direct Action Ruckus Society, kicked off a new initiative to put the party back in American politics. The Rolling Thunder Down Home Democracy Tour, as it is called, is a traveling political carnival that features speeches, music, games, and food, all designed to build a sense of community among activist groups who often operate in isolation from one another. Congressman Jesse Jackson Jr. and movie maker Michael Moore were among the luminaries who spoke to a crowd of more than 6,000 at the Rolling Thunder's Austin Coming Out Party. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with Jim Hightower about the historical roots of the Democracy Tour and what he hopes to achieve with this unique roadshow that will crisscross the country this summer.
A great group of people and organizations have come together, ranging from National Council of Churches to the Ruckus Society, from the CWA, Communication Workers of America, to ACORN, United Students Against Sweatshops, to the PIRGs. We've come together, about 40 different organizations, to foster a coalition-building process among progressive groups at a local level all across the country. This came from my experience going into local communities and finding that there's this enormous progressive activity happening, unlike in Washington, D.C., at the grassroots. It's an exciting time for progressives. Yet somebody fighting for a living wage on one side of town don't know the people fighting against a toxic waste dump on the other side of town. We have the parts of a movement are out there, but we're not connected. And so to create an excuse for getting connected or for improving our connection, why not have what we're calling Democracy Fest, in which we spend a day or a day and a half in a coalition-building process that doesn't use words like coalition-building. Instead, an event that people might actually want to come to because it would be fun. Our slogan is, let's put the party back in politics. So in addition to great speeches and excellent engaging workshops and training sessions, we're having terrific music, food and beer and wine. We're having clowns. Patch Adams is a part of this, so he's turning out clown troops. We're having stuff for kids and farmers markets, restaurants and chefs to get involved and provide food for people. We're having games that Ben and Jerry have developed in their priorities campaign that Ben Cohen heads up, where you can take the hammer and try to ring the bell, the old carnival game, you know, except this bell deals with, you know, how high you go depends on, do you want a nuclear missile for that, or do you want 100 new schools built, you know, that kind of thing. And so it's an exciting possibility. Think of it like a county fair of progressive activism. That's really what it is, of democracy building. We had our first one in Austin, and it was a phenomenal success. Better than 7,000 people turned out for it. We had me and Molly Ivins, Granny D, Jesse Jackson Jr., and Michael Moore were the speakers. We had great music from Michelle Schacht, Marsha Ball, Medusa, Overlord, Ruben Ramos and the Texas Revolution. We had all kinds of music there. We had a dozen Austin restaurants providing food. So these things are designed to try to put progress back in progressive, and to do it, as I say, in a way that that is actually fun.
I wanted to ask you about the origins of this idea, which I heard came from the Chautauqua meetings all over the country that began back in the late 1800s.
Right. This is a revival, really, of that Chautauqua spirit, which was a Methodist-led Enlightenment movement, as you say, in the late 1800s, beginning in Chautauqua, New York. In fact, the original Chautauqua Park is still there. And folks would come and camp for 10 days, 2 weeks. They'd swim in Lake Chautauqua. They would cook food and cook out. They would hear great orators and music. They would put on plays, and they would form glee clubs, and they would do crafts and all of that. It became so popular that then they took it on the road. And at one point, there were like 65 different circuits of these Chautauquas, taking tents and traveling by train or whatever, going across the country and reaching as many as 35 million people a year. So we've taken that, updated it, given it a progressive political push, and going to the countryside with it in that populist spirit of the original Chautauqua idea.
Jim, what do you tangibly hope comes out of the gatherings of various local groups as they sponsor this Rolling Thunder Down Home Democracy Tour?
Several things. We'll get stronger coalitions of groups at a local level, meaning that our whole effort will be stronger than the individual parts of the progressive effort. We will have a better trained citizenry because these are not our workshops and training sessions, and even the speeches are not whine sessions. We're saying no whining. We don't want to hear again about all the problems. We want to know, what are we going to do about it? How can local people take power back? Take power back from the WTO greed heads, take power back from the HMOs, take power back from the lobbyists that have stolen our government, take power back from the big money interests, et cetera. How to take power back very personally, like how do you talk to your doctor? Why do you only get 7 minutes? You could actually have more time, you know, and here's how to do it. So very hands-on how-to type of stuff, and training people to be able to have more citizenship skills and more ability to assert local power is coming out of this. And then a third thing is just a spirit and a sense of celebration. People are amazed in any given town, including here in Austin, about, well, I didn't know there was that much going on. You know, I didn't know this group existed or this effort was being made on the other side of town. So you realize that you're not alone, and also you realize that together we can be something. We can be the true power in this country.
That was populist commentator, author, and organizer Jim Hightower. For more information about the Rolling Thunder Tour and how to organize one in your community, call area code 510-645-1027 or visit the tour's website at www.rollingthundertour.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced by WPKN Radio's Public Affairs and News Departments. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, or would like a cassette copy of today's program, please contact Between the Lines by calling area code 203-331-9756, or write to Between the Lines, care of WPKN Radio, 244 University Avenue, Bridgeport, Connecticut, 06604. You can also visit our website at www.btlonline.org. Our theme music was written and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Scott Harris with the assistance of Denise Manzari, Anna Manzo, Harry Minot, Bob Nixon, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Archibald Curry.